the UCR podcast.
There was a slap in the face. How quickly I was replaced. And I had faith in the mate when you because the love that you gave that we made wasn't able to make.
For those of us who were alive in 1995, hearing Alanis Morissette's You Oughta Know on radio and MTV was a moment because, as you heard lyrically, she came out swinging and got straight to the point, and that's the second verse. In the first verse of You Oughta Know, Morissette asks the question that has become an iconic line in pop culture. You can probably get it on a t-shirt at this point. Would she go down on you in a theater? Music fans who heard that, the first single from Jagged Little Pill, were instantly aware that this was not just another album. We all have these records as fans that we encounter that become lifetime favorites because they present a soundtrack that matches up with what we're experiencing in our own life. And in some cases, as author Selena Fergassi notes, the true meaning of the songs becomes apparent as we go through our own evolution, as we grow up, as we go through our first breakup, as we navigate college, moving out, getting our first job in the real world, getting married, having children. There are songs on Jagged Little Pill that may have been running in the background, soothing and guiding your heart as you went through all of these things. For me, the moment when I was going through my first real breakup, the song was Your House, a track which unbelievably was the unlisted bonus track on Jagged Little Pill, and it's arguably one of the best songs to ever be buried on an album, but no worries, the fans found it. Selena has written a new book called Alanis, 30 Years of Jagged Little Pill. That's out now from Epic Inc. and the Quarto Group, and it's a really forensic look at an album that has remained one of my favorites, and perhaps it is still one of yours too. I was excited to get a chance to dig into the story behind the record with Selena recently, just a few days before the book was released, and she's been busy because the same day that came out, she also put out a book on Greta Gerwig, and that one is called Greta, The Work, Life, and Style of Greta Gerwig. Both books are available now wherever you get your books, and if you can, support your independent booksellers. You can find some of those indie stores if you don't have one in your area by going to bookshop.org. It's Matt Wardlaw. Big thanks to all of you for being here and listening to the UCR podcast. If you enjoy what we do, don't forget to check out everything else we have going on at ultimateclassicrock.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, please follow it and you'll receive future episodes. It helps as well if you can take the time to rate and review wherever you are listening. Here's our interview with Selena Fergassi. Enjoy. Well, I am so glad we get to talk about Jagged Little Pill today because it is an album that I think for the generation that came up with it, they have lived a whole journey with the songs on this record. And albums like that are always really special. And Selena, I would love to start there and have you talk about your initial entry point with the album, because I read it. I think it's a humorous story that I think people will appreciate. And then to just add a second part to that, like, what do you feel like the journey is that you took with this record as a person and as a music fan?
Oh my gosh, so much to say. But yes, the story is random. Like, it was my uncle. You know, everyone's got the crazy uncle, but mine was actually awesome. And he was a huge fan of, in particular, women singer-songwriters in the 90s. And so as I was being curious about music and developing my taste as a teenager, he like introduced me to a lot of really amazing artists. And so, but specifically Alanis, I remember we were in the car one day. I still have no idea where we were going, but it was me, my cousin, his daughter, and my uncle. And he was playing Jagged Little Pill. It must have just been like when the album came out. And I was 13 and still in Catholic grade school. And I was like, Uncle Bob, like, what the hell are we listening to? These words, my virgin ears. And he's like, okay, I get it, but just promise me in a couple years that you play this album in full. It's going to mean something to you. It always stuck with me. That memory just so stuck with me because he was really right. I mean, a few years later, that album still was so monolithic. And I was, a bit more mature in my teenagehood. And I listened to it again, and it did mean something to me. And it's meant something to me ever since. And it changes in meaning every time I hear it at a different life stage. Whether I've like gone through a recent break and I'm like, hell yeah, You Oughta Know, like right on, that's my song right now. Or if I'm feeling really strained and at my limit, like Perfect hits me, you know, being a stepmom now, there's so many ways to grow with this album over time, which I think makes it so incredibly special and so very much universal.
Yeah, 100%. And first of all, like before we move on, like I do love that your uncle was, you described in some form, like his just Lilith Fair fandom as a music fan. And, you know, I think that's something that I've really always appreciated being a music fan, is just the various gateways that we have as music fans. And I kind of love that your uncle was like the gateway for you in, you know, being introduced to a lot of those different kind of artists, like, because that was all the stuff that he was into. It's just like stuff like that, like, it's just priceless.
It's my uncle and my dad. Like, it's so random how I got my music taste both really from them. I mean, as a kid, my dad was a huge music fan. We had Motown Sundays where he would put on a new album vinyl and we'd dance around and have pancakes. That's my best childhood memory. But then as I got older, like, he was a huge fan of Heart. He was a huge fan of just blues, of everything. But I think, like, what I really appreciate about my dad and my uncle is that they introduced me to a lot of women in music. And it just really set a foundation for me that women can be a part of this world. And it made me explore my own part of it, you know, obviously not becoming a musician because I suck, but becoming a music journalist, you know. I think that they gave me a really good foundation to show representation of really awesome women in the field.
So with some distance at this point, like, what do you appreciate about, like, these songs that Alanis was writing in this era?
Okay, first of all, she was like 19, 20. She was 21 when the album came out. I don't know where she had all this gumption and all this experience and all this ability to put it into words the way she did. That to me is fascinating. Like, I, having been through my 20s, knowing 20-year-olds, like, that's incredible. She was just so beyond her time. I think, you know, I knew a bit about her past before, but really digging into her pop star past and what she dealt with as a kid star and our understanding now of what has happened to kid stars, especially with those documentaries coming out. I think the way that she not only survived that, but she fueled it into this album was, and shared it with the rest of the world, was just really incredible. And I think, you know, really looking into the chemistry she had with Glenn Ballard, who's the real unsung hero of this album, and very much is Alanis, but he very much was the catalyst and the angel and the devil on her shoulder, like, bringing these thoughts out of her. So I think so much credit goes to him too.
Yeah, 100%. And I appreciate what you said about her being like 19, 20 years old at the time, because you can say this about a lot of songs on this record, but, like, for example, you know, listening to Your House, like, it is incredible to think about a person at that age writing songs like that. And I think that, like, again, as music fans, like, as we get further into our fandom, it's like you start going back to some of your records that you loved and you're like, how were they even writing about some of this stuff at the time? Like, it's just so, as they say, far beyond the years, like, some of the stuff that she was writing about. But as you say, like, you know, everything she had, like, gone through being a child star and just everything, you know, that led up to this record, she had been through a lot before she even stepped into. I know that as a music fan, I was shocked in the world where, like, the internet was still kind of new. Mm-hmm. You know, you're listening to this quote unquote debut album, Jagged Little Pill, and then all of a sudden you find out, oh, no, no, no. She did all this before. And by the way, she did two albums before Jagged Little Pill. So she had this whole extensive kind of career before she put out her quote unquote debut album. So she did have more life experience, I think, than a lot of people gave her credit for at that point.
She did. And there's a very strong case for the theme of perseverance in this album. I mean, she was dropped from MCA Records Canada after the second album, Now Is Time, didn't really sell as much as her first album because she was changing. The way she was writing music, if you listen to Real World, you can feel the jagged songwriter in there. It's like, and the video too. And they didn't like it. And she could have been a one-hit wonder. She could have stopped. She literally went on blind dates with 100 other songwriting partners and they all didn't pan out. And it's like, she, no label wanted her. She went right through you. It was about all the executives who were like, we don't like you, we want to change you. And she stuck through it. And it's just, it also makes me wonder, like, what's all the other music we didn't hear of because people gave up, couldn't get a deal. It just, it kind of breaks my heart, but it also just is such a really good message. I think Mitch Schneider says it, the publicist in the book, of, he always tells bands, an example of Alanis, of literally don't give up. She had all the odds stacked against her, and you never know what magic can happen. So
one of the things that I remember seeing here in recent years was, you know, sometime in the past couple of years when Alanis was, I think, playing Austin City Limits, and that was, like, you know, broadcast on, you know, YouTube or whatever the case was, but we were watching that, and she is just so fearless and so dominant. And, you know, sometimes, and I know you probably watched a lot of video as you were in the process of, like, researching this book, but, like, sometimes it's like an artist works up to that. But as I was watching that Austin City Limits performance, what really kind of struck me was that, like, man, it's like if you saw like the performances she was giving on the Jagged Little Pill tour, she was already there. Like she was so fierce on stage. I think not only was it shocking to hear something like You Ought to Know on the radio or whatever, but like she had the persona that matched up perfectly with these songs that you were hearing on the radio, because like she just came out on stage and just you know, it's cliche, but she just destroyed these stages. And you know, of course, obviously we see like she had like, you know, an incredible band, Taylor Hawkins on drums and all, you know, all these people. So she, the whole package was pretty incredible to witness, like both her and musically the folks that she was playing with, they really were kind of a gang, a unit. But that's what I kind of keep coming back to about this story with Alanis, is there's just so much developmental stuff that usually happens that you kind of see this person kind of come up in front of your eyes with, like, especially with a big record like this. Oftentimes it's like somebody will put out a big record like this, and you kind of get to see, even if they've had a couple records like she did going into this one, you kind of see them, you know, really blossom into the artist that they're going to be. But really, like, she kind of came out fully formed with this record, and it's still, I think that's one thing that I appreciated about reading your book here as we're at the 30-year mark, is that like 30 years later, like just how fully formed she emerged, both with the record and with the live performance and just everything that she was able to just unleash with Jagged Little Pill. It's still really impressive.
I think it's, I talk about it in the book, but there was like, even in video, this amazing shift that happened from just a few years, like when she was 17, coming on 18, when she was graduating high school, CBC Canada, their big news network, did like a little documentary on her. And she's got like this permed hair, and she's singing George Michael in her car, and she's hanging out with friends by the locker, and she's making mac and cheese at home, and she's all smiles and, you know, typical like teenage pop star. And literally like just 2-3 years later, she's being interviewed by MTV, 120 minutes, I think it was, during the Jagged Little Pill promo. And her, like, she's locking eyes with the journalist. She's like hating their questions, you can tell. And at one point, a PA comes over, literally interrupts her train of thought. And he's like, "You, Miss Morissette, you have a hair in your face." And the look she gives him, and she's like, "I don't really care." Oh my God. Like, it was night and day. She really was like, she lived the persona of Jagged Little Pill. She was so authentic in it. And I think there were really, really good decisions on behalf of her team. Like, for example, her manager, Scott Welch, is in the book, and he talks about the fact that he did not want her to go on a singer-songwriter tour. He did not want her to play Lilith Fair either. And he wanted her to have a rock band behind her to bring out that aggression and to keep, or not even aggression, but passion, and to keep her in the alt-rock world. And so that's why you had Taylor Hawkins on drums. Chris Chaney, Jane's Addiction, is on bass. And then a few other really great instrumentalists as well. But it was smart the way that she was marketed and the package put together too.
Yeah, 100%. And that's, you know, you've kind of circled around this a couple times, and it was something I was thinking about as I was getting ready to talk to you. And that just is, like, you are a writer, but also, like, you know, part of your world is that you're a publicist. Like, so it just feels like some of the things that you've said, it feels like you've already kind of answered what I wondered. But like, did your work as a publicist kind of inform your view as you were in the research process? It seems like that would give you kind of an additional lens you'd be looking through.
Yeah, that's such a great question. No one's brought that up yet. And I think you're right. I think because I do toe the line between a journalist, obviously, a much more long-time journalist than I am publicist, but I have towed the line between those two worlds. And I think I was coming at it from both ways. I think the investigative, the reporting, digging deep into her story. But I think also I was fascinated. That's why I interviewed her publicist. I really was fascinated with how they did try to brand her, what the reaction was in the beginning. Because, of course, she wasn't the first to do this. You had Peter Harvey and you had Tori Amos and Liz Phair before her. But the way that she was marketed made it stand out, and she became so commercial. And I think that obviously was her. She was a pop star, so she was writing songs that were very catchy. But I think it's also because of the way her team marketed her. It was just really, really smart. And so, yeah, I did think about that a lot writing this book.
It's kind of interesting because, like, if you think about what was happening with alternative music in the 90s, like, you know, one thing that kind of made me think of was that, like, for a lot of folks, like, what was going on in that time with alternative music, it's almost really kind of like a similar thing to what, you know, other people had prior to that with, like, punk rock, with Sex Pistols and The Clash. And, like, I think you can make a case that, like, Jagged Little Pill was the combat rock for certain music fans of that generation.
Oh, yeah. And I think there's definitely a case for the fact that Nevermind came out a few years prior, was still such a huge album by this point, and it opened up the gates of this kind of angsty rebellion young music after punk, right? starting off grunge. But then Alanis filled another hole where it was, while it was for everyone, it really like was resonating with women. And I don't think women felt that with, you know, the other stars of that era. I mean, even though like, my God, they, I mean, I love Tori Amos and I love PJ, but they weren't in the same, they were a little bit more obtuse, I think, in the way that they wrote their music and delivered it. Very, very poetic, but there was something very guttural and in your face and marketable and commercial about Alanis that just filled that niche.
Obviously, one angle that you had was Jagged Little Pill was turning 30, but like how, just overall, like how did you land on kind of like the overall angle or arcs of how you wanted to approach the book that you kind of had in your head? How did that kind of take shape?
I think it took shape as I was researching it. I think I just knew that this was the anniversary and I did have my outline for the things I wanted to include in the book. But, you know, I think it just kind of flowed as I was researching it. And I think there became this idea that, yes, even though it's 30, it is still so impactful. It is still an album you can grow with, and it's still evolving. I mean, the fact that she has a whole Broadway play where Diablo Cody was able to pick up out characters and a narrative, not only create a whole storyline with a family, but make it relevant for when it came out, which was right around the pandemic and stayed around for a few years. So I think, you know, it wasn't just an anniversary book. It was like this living organism looking at it still from those eyes and all the tentacles it's had. And also, I mean, the conversation that has to be had about how she paved the way for so many modern confessional singer-songwriters. I, you know, would we have a Taylor Swift? Would we have an Olivia Rodrigo? Would they have been compelled to write the way they did if they hadn't heard Jagged Little Pill? You know, and I think, I can't remember who in the book talks about it, but, you know, Alanis really kind of broke the glass ceiling. Lilith Fair kind of, you know, happened for many reasons, but I think promoters found that there could be success for it because she sold 33 million albums and she made, Scott Wolf said, she was the first woman to make 300 million for a record label. So it was the idea that women were not only a voice, but, you know, in the dollar eyes of other industry people that like, okay, we have something we can make money off for better or worse, but it did give a platform for a lot more to come after that.
Yeah, and I kind of like that she was, you know, on Maverick. So she's on this record label that's also kind of a renegade label. Like, it's just like all the right pieces were in place to, like, you know, for what happened, like when you kind of look back at, you know, everything that was the way everything was situated.
I mean, literally, I love a story about when she went to Maverick. So she had just been robbed like days before that meeting. Yeah. She was so shook up. She was just praying that the people who robbed her wouldn't take her backpack because it had all of her lyrics for Jagged Little Pill in it. And she didn't even know that there was going to be a meeting that day with, like, you know, the Maverick offices. And she literally went in her sweatpants. She wasn't wearing any makeup and she played perfect. And Guy Osiri talks about, like, I knew from that minute. She was like living what she was talking about and she didn't have to be done up. It was so the opposite of her pop star past that it's just such a, it was a really, I can't even imagine like being in the room at that point, how kinetic it was. So
yeah, it's kind of like you hear with, like, you know, Jewel, like, you know, at points being like homeless and living in her car leading up to like the big record. Yeah. It's just like that's all an authenticity that cannot be manufactured, right?
Exactly. You can't. Like, you can't. And I find it so interesting that both she and Glenn Ballard came from the pop world. Glenn Ballard had worked with Paula Abdul before that, Wilson Phillips. And they both just totally backpedaled on what their style was. And they just somehow created this out of one take. She didn't want to redo her vocals. Like, nothing was polished about it. And yet it became, probably because of that, it became such a huge work of art.
I don't fully know this. Like, how much did she know about Glenn Ballard going in? Because it's, you know, it's easy to, it's easy to think that if she had known that, like, this is the Wilson Phillips guy, she would be like, no, this guy, I'm not doing this record with him. Like, it's like, like, it's so, but you're right. Like, he's, And I've had some interaction with Glenn. Like, you know, he's a guy obviously that we know now has done a lot of different things, but it's just like it is, that's another kind of key part of this whole puzzle is the fact that, like, he ended up working with her. You know, it was the right match. Like, he was the right person to help, like, kind of bring this to the surface.
Well, and the funny thing is that his name had come up before, and she had like these Svengali type of producers and people behind her when she was doing the pop star stuff, and in particular Leslie Howe, who just, my goodness, what he put her through. And they, Glenn Ballard's name came up because they were trying to figure out a way to market her and get her more into the U.S. territories. And he had worked with Paula Abdul. And if you listen to her album, she kind of sounded like Paula and Janet. But I think it was Leslie Howe put the kibosh on it because he's like, no, I'm working with her as her producer. He wouldn't let her. So it's funny how things kind of play out the way they did, because I think it was that time that they had to meet, you know. And I don't think she knew much about him going into it. I think it was a setup through her label. And the thing that she talks about is, like, the first time they met, they had some tea, but they were so aligned in terms of philosophy and spirituality. And they would start every session with, like, deep conversation. And it was the starting point to kick off where her kind of brain went with the very stream of consciousness writing that she was doing. So, yeah, it was just also organic.
For you, like, what were some of the really, like, interesting things you uncovered researching this book, perhaps things you didn't know or were surprised to learn? Like, yeah, you laid out a lot just then, I think, you know. But,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But even, like, you know, when she was a kid, she was very into Olivia Newton-John in Grease. I would never have expected that of Alanis. and, you know, the whole trip to India was really interesting to me. It came actually at the suggestion of her brother, her twin brother, Wade, he took a trip to India, like, in the time of Jagged Little Pill, because he was trying to figure out his own life. And here's my sister who's a superstar, and what does this mean for me? And she's my twin. And it changed his life. And so she was so burned out after the promo and touring cycle for Jagged Little Pill. She literally said she didn't smile for 2 years. It was just so traumatic and run of the mill. And she needed a break. And she didn't even know if she would write another album. And he suggested, you know, go there. It's going to help you. And she did. And she spent a year and she was just living her life and doing yoga and meditation. She was working at the orphanage that Mother Teresa had been steering. And it just changed her life. And it changed the trajectory of her music, because she never really, she had the passion behind the other albums that came after, but it was never the same kind of sound or angsty or, I mean, it was more like what I compare in the book is more like, therapy to, like, journaling, you know. It was just like raw and trying to figure it out. And then it was like, I'm going to be more at peace and analyze this. And it's just interesting how different decisions she made really affected the rest of her career too.
Yeah. I mean, as we know, she did not just go back for that next record and make Jagged Little Pill Part 2. Like, she really took a left turn, and that would be something that has become really kind of just trademark for her in all the records that, this is what I love with any artist that, like, pursues the path, but she always feels like somebody who has made the album that she wants to make at the time, whatever that album might be. And I love that she, again, is fearless in that way and just pursues that path. Even, I don't know, I don't feel like the label would have necessarily been too thrilled with that album that she handed in, but it's just like, you know, that's the record she made. You know, yeah. And it's like we've seen that with a number of artists, but I think that was one of the big ones that, like, kind of perhaps in the eyes of various folks did not measure up to what they were expecting from the artist that had given them Jagged Little Pill previously. So, but again, that's just part of, in my view, her fearless nature. That's just like, she was always following the muse, which is the way it should be. And, you know, you talked about the trip to India and all that kind of stuff. It's just like, obviously she came away with some very powerful things from that experience that went right back artistically, as things often do. It went right back into the music that came after that.
Yeah. I think she's very much an experience driven artist, and every album she's had, like you said, it's very temporal. It's like what's going on at that time or in her life stage. I mean, her latter music is very much about her children. And so, yeah, she's always taken from the moment, I think, more than just having like a style necessarily.
What were some of the hardest dots to connect as far as periods or sections of her career that you wanted to verify or flesh out?
Yeah, I think her childhood, there's not like a ton out there about that period. And for me, that's always the most fascinating. Like, how do people get to be who they are? I mean, I would have loved to have known more, a bit more about her parents. And they spent time in Germany working for like NATO through like for schools in Germany. I would have loved to know more about that time, but I couldn't find that much out about that. It's actually really fascinating because she was on that show on PBS called Finding Your Roots. And they talk a bit about how her family were involved in the Holocaust. And that, I mean, even for her, that was a revelation for her. But I think, you know, and just the idea of when she was when she had been dropped by MCA Records in Canada, it was very much a migratory period. I mean, she was living in Ottawa, which is like a tiny, in comparison to other markets in Canada, a tinier town. And then they wanted her, her team was suggesting, you know, move to Toronto. You need a bit more life experience. And then from there, she got to LA. So like the confluence of that and the timeline of that was a little bit hard to discern, and why those decisions were made, and how much time she spent in each and what that did for her. So I think like that would have been great to kind of dig into that more as well, if there was more information about that. But for me, it's always like the beginning, like what, how this person ended up being who they are. How did she shift so much from who she was with Alanis and Now Is the Time to Jagged Little Pill? And, you know, she hasn't opened up as much about those experiences, but they sound very harrowing. And in fact, when she did open up about it in that HBO documentary, she then disavowed it. So it's just, I feel like she's so much close to the chest that, you know, and that's her right. But it would be kind of interesting to know if she was to open up a bit more about what happened to her.
And it feels unfortunate. I mean, only she knows, you know, why she was, why that documentary veered in a direction that she didn't appreciate. But it's just like, as a fan, when I saw that documentary, I just thought it was a very honest.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I thought it was a really good documentary. So I was very surprised when she came out and, as you say, disavowed it.
Yeah, I was too. And I felt like it was so honest. And I feel like, you know, the whole thing with the Me Too movement is the more women who speak up about it, the more who also feel safe to do so. And we can learn from it. And so, you know, that movie came out, that documentary came out like around the time of Me Too. And I was really surprised why she didn't want to be a part of it, or thought that her words were taken out of context, because it was very raw. Yeah.
When it comes to Jagged Little Pill as an album, there, you know, albums like that, like, especially when you're 30 years removed, like there's the mythology. Do you feel like as you were working on this book, were there any things like, you know, kind of things that are part of the mythology, murky truths, things that are not true at all, that you were able to kind of like uncover in the process of, you know, working on this book?
Yeah. So obviously the question of who is You Ought to Know About, everyone still wants to know. She's never come out and said it, although she said that Dave Coulier is the most vocal about it. And it's funny because, you know, when I talked to her manager, Scott Welch, he said, it is about one person. I do know who it is about. Of course, he didn't want to divulge it because she hasn't. But when I was reading interviews with her, she was saying it wasn't really about one person. It was really more about just this buildup of all these experiences she had and just wanting to get those feelings out. And so I still don't know who that song is about. My Carruthers say it's about Dave Coulier because the timing would match up. And just there was such an age difference there that I wonder if that was, you know, there's some lines in her song that would make it make sense. But yeah, I think, you know, the question of other murkiness, that was the big one, I think, with like, you know, Perfect was very revealing about who she just was as a person. She, in so many interviews, she talked about just being this perfectionist and, you know, the idea that she had eating disorders that were really spurred on by the control of Leslie Howe and his team. And in that documentary, she talks about how they would like count pieces of cheese. It was disgusting just how they would control.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was horrible. And so I think, you know, when you listen to these songs at face value, like even back then when all these details hadn't come out yet, reading more about it, she's written essays like at every anniversary too, which have been really cool. And I can't wait to see what she writes next week, actually, for the 30th, because I'm sure it'll be very interesting as well. Yeah.
What did you come to appreciate about this record? You know, I think there's like how you love a record going into it, but then it's like, you know, as you come away from the experience of working on something like this, were there things that you had a greater appreciation for or just felt differently about?
Yeah, I think knowing that everything was done very much in first takes and there wasn't a lot of, she refused to redo vocals and they really didn't have more than like Flea and Dave Navarro coming on the album and a few people after that. It was really just Glenn and Alanis. And I think I've always been a big proponent of the Allen Ginsberg idea of first thought, best thought. And so I was really impressed by the fact that she stuck to her guns with that music, even though everyone wanted her to redo it. And she's like, I'm not redoing it. I don't want this to sound like, you know, a Steely Dan record, I think is what she said. And the fact that she had such conviction. I mean, it was her decision to start with You Ought to Know. Nobody wanted to make that a single. They just thought it was like, really, that's where you want to start? And she's like, no, I want to get in their faces and then draw them in and get them to take it layer by layer through all the emotions I'm going through on this album. So, and I, you know, the fact you brought it up earlier, but the fact that it was a woman run label who gave her the shot and then they proved everybody wrong, that just made my heart so happy. And it wasn't just Madonna, though. Madonna did love Alanis, of course, but Guy Ossiri was really the same age as Alanis. And he was very taken aback by her and said, you know, this very much was a generational thing because, you know, kids who were growing up in the 90s, they didn't really know who Joni Mitchell was at that point. They didn't have their, like, kind of folk singer-songwriter hero. And he felt that in her. And so I think, you know, there's just very much this idea of right place, right time, but also very much of the time. And but it spans generations. It wasn't just Gen X. Now it's millennials and it's Gen Z who are loving this album too. And so I think it's just really stayed a living organism over this whole time.
That's a really interesting point too about You Ought to Know, because it's just like, I hadn't really thought about that, but like if it had been a different label than Maverick, they might have said, we're not going to put this out as the first single because, like, oh my God, we're going to get banned from Walmart and everywhere else that likes to ban things. They're all going to ban this record before it has a shot to do anything. So it's just like, if she had been with a more conservative label, it's just like, a lot of things could have gone differently because they might have just, I don't know, been threatened by the possibility of all the things that could go wrong, all the domino effect that could be touched off if they put this song out first.
Yeah, I think Maverick is trying to figure out who the heck they were at this stage, too. They were pretty much a newer label at that point. I think, like, their big hit at that point was just Candlebox, which is, you know, Candlebox. Yeah. Don't know, no shit on Candlebox. Sure. But I think that they were kind of, they were listening to her. She wouldn't have had that, with, like you said, with one more corporate label structure. K-Rock has to just be mentioned in this story, too, because they just kicked it off. They kicked off the whole avalanche because they played this song, didn't censor it. Everyone I talked to for this book is like, I remember hearing it. I was driving on the 405 or something, and here the song came on, and they dialed up the station. It lit up their boards, and it was the most requested song for months because they just took a chance on it. They actually took a chance on Head Over Feet, too. It wasn't a single yet, and they're like, we're going to play the next one. So K-Rock kind of, like, helped move her career along, which, you know, at that point, alternative radio was huge. So
what do you kind of hope that people will take away from this book?
I hope an appreciation for not only this album and the real depth behind the story. I hope people will hear it differently like I did after reading this book. But I hope on a more global scale, it just gives real appreciation for women artists. And, you know, they've always, now, of course, women are ruling the charts, but they weren't always. And I think there's a lot to be said about the way that women really bring a lot of emotion to their music. Not that men can't either, but I think it's a whole different kind of way that they approach it. And I think, you know, as we look at all the artists nowadays and the through lines, I just think it's really important to just, you know, and not just women, like all different creators, like people of color. I just think it shows that, you know, there's so much strength in having diversity in the music scene. And I hope that that becomes relevant to people as well.
Something that I just thought about as you were talking about all that is, like, it's interesting to, like, think about everything that was going on with Lilith and, you know, people like Alanis getting played. Like, as a music fan, like, these were just artists that I liked. They weren't guys. They weren't women. I didn't look at them that way. But it is interesting to think about the fact that even at the time that Alanis was getting radio play, it's like they were still, you know, focused on the fact that you couldn't play two women artists in a row, you know, and so there you had these battles where it's just like, well, we can't add the Alanis song right now because we're already playing this song from this other, you know, woman artist, this other female band, whatever the case is. And so I think that, like, sometimes people like to look back at, like, say, like the 90s or whatever and go, oh, you know, we don't have, you know, they didn't have the same thing that we have now where it's like women can't really get played on the radio. But it really was kind of, unfortunately, the same kind of thing, which is, it just, as a music fan, it baffles me that things are that way, because just, like, at the end of the day, a good song is a good song. A good album is just a good album. Like, it shouldn't be about the fact, you know, it shouldn't be gender related.
I mean, the sexism that was happening in that time was just appalling to me. The fact that, like, yes, labels wouldn't, like, sign her because, like, we have Sinead, we have Jewel, we have PJ, like, we don't need you, we're good. And then when she was given a shot and she came out, and because, yes, it did start with You Ought to Know, she was labeled as the angry young woman. If you look at the Rolling Stone and Spin covers in November of that year, she was on both at the same time. It's like, seriously, like, she's not just an angry young, she's an expressive young woman, but they just wanted to zero in on that one line of, you know, lyrics in that song. And even, you know, she played Woodstock, my God, the maligned Woodstock in 99, with right ahead of Limp Bizkit. And there's a part in the book where I talk about how, like, awful Limp Bizkit was talking about her and women literally being assaulted while they were just trying to watch Alanis. I mean, that just what was the whole paradigm in that era is just something that was so gross. And I'm glad we've gotten past it a bit, and I hope we keep staying on the course. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, what is next after this book? What's kind of next project wise?
So, this very same day that Alanis comes out on June 10th, my book on Greta Gerwig is also going to be out.
So fantastic.
It was great writing about two awesome women around the same time and just like how powerful they both are. And so had such a vision and changed the whole dichotomy. So that book will be coming out as well. And then they're not announced yet, but I have a few more if you want me to tell you, but they're not public.
Cool.
Yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So tell you or no? Okay.
After we turn the microphones off. There we go.
Perfect. All right. Yeah.
Well, we'll wrap it up here then. Thank you so much. I know that folks are, I'm glad you mentioned the Greta book. I will talk about both those in the intro, but it's just like, admittedly, I forgot about that, but people have two books to get excited about. And you're right. You didn't say it this way, but they should really pick them up both on the same day. It's a great move. I agree. Well, hey, thank you so much for the time on this. We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.